what happened? So these reports, see, this, particularly this 2006 report, the Joint Economic Research Programme report, you know, it was quite influential. I mean, the government was open, they listened to this and said, we need to do something. But what is the environment in which they're going to do something? Well, at the national level, 2007 was when the housing bubble burst, as I mentioned earlier. This was associated with distrust of market mechanisms. You know, saying, well, look, we relied on opening up the banking sector. We even allowed a foreign bank to come in here. And look what happens when you have the market. I find it's a bit surprising, because if any country in the world that's benefited from markets, it's been Kazakhstan. They benefited from the oil markets having this huge increase in price. But you know, many people in the government were distrusting market mechanisms. There's also, starting a bit earlier, and a bit similar, I believe, to what was happening in Russia, there was increased economic nationalism in the oil and gas sector. So the state company, Kazmunaigaz, starting about 2002, 2003, there's a clear push to have Kazmunaigaz involved in the major oil and gas projects and to get a large percentage in there. To make sure that the resources were going to the country, you have a national company involved. And so the reaction to suggestions that the agricultural policy wasn't working so well was to reorganize rather than to reform institutions. So one reaction could have been to say, we'll stop these price supports, we'll stop all this intervention. Right? That there was the opposite reaction, was say, we've got to reorganize and make the institutions work better. And we see this happening also on the national level, when the banks that collapsed in 2008 were incorporated into a state holding company, Samruk Kazyna, which also included many other companies, including Kazmunaigaz, including Air Astana, the main airline. And in 2009, IMF estimated that this single state holding company covered over half of GDP, its affiliates. And so it's massive movement away from a private economy to a kind of state capitalism. And this is what we see in agriculture. Why I think agriculture is interesting in this context. We see it's a mirror of what's happening at the national level. That what we see happening in agriculture is the consolidation of policy-related institutions. So that institution that's supporting the grain sector, the institution supporting the livestock sector, and the credit institution, the institution giving insurance to farmers, the institution dealing with marketing agricultural goods, are all brought together into a single holding company, Kazagro, which initially is under the Minister of Agriculture, but you know, gradually becomes a world of its own. And we see associated with this is a huge additional increase in the budget. You know, remember, there's been this big program in 2003, 2005, a little bit of a slowdown, and then by two. So, what are the numbers I had up here? So the budget for Minister of Agriculture, 81 billion tenge in 2005, 81 billion. And what we're seeing here is that the minister, by 2008, the budget's gone up to 139 billion. And this inflation's not very high, so the nominal figures tell you the story. And in 2008, 45% of that is going to Kazagro. In the crisis program, when there's your money's taken out of the national fund to stimulus to the economy that's suffering from the banking crisis, Kazagro was one of the main recipients. It gets 120 billion tenge. In other words, pretty much equal to the size of a whole agriculture budget the previous year. And if we look at the budget, now the last one I have access to was 2011, just 2011-2012 financial year, 92% of that was going to price support and subsidized credit. So there's a separate entity, Kazagro Innovation, responsible for promoting technical change, but overwhelmingly we see the budget is about providing price support and financing. So if we look at the evolution of agricultural policy, and we see dramatic change. There's pretty much a laissez-faire policy, or a lack of interest policy, I'd say, in the second half of the 1990s. And in the last decade, the last 11 or 12 years, the level and composition of spending on agriculture has increased very dramatically. And especially we see after 2008, it increased even further and increasingly, you know, channeled through this parastatal government holding company, Casagro. And we see the nature of the policy has changed in that the share of subsidies in total spending on agriculture has gone up from 6%, 24%, 39% in 2009, over 40% today. And most of this is going in now, is goes in subsidies related to output. And in the same period, the spending on the share spending on infrastructure fell from 16% to 5%. And on crop and livestock services, you know, vets, seed improvement, so on, also dropped slightly. You know, the difference between these is administration costs and so on. So, what are the features of the current agricultural policy? Well, the policy is based on selective assistance. So when we talk about the subsidies and the credit, subsidized credit, the priority loans are going to 8 subsectors. And so clearly what we see in terms of government policy, of which this is a part, is the government shifting from a more laissez-faire policy, market-oriented policy, to using the money they have to try to pick winners. And I think that there's a certain psychological obviousness about that. If you've got a lot of money and the market's not changing fast enough, there's a tendency to think you can do better by identifying the places you should put the money. The central government also trying to keep control of this. It's a very big, diverse country. Yeah, the regions have to be responsible for implementation. But the central, the Ministry of Agriculture and Casagro in Astana are really trying to maintain control to say they're going to ensure coherence. We see the evaluation of the policies is primarily in terms of quantitative targets. A successful policy is one that increases output. There's very little concern for allocative efficiency or productivity. Very little concern for saying, could the resources have been better used? So we're focusing on grain and meat, for example. Would it be better to put some of those resources into oil crops or something else? Right? There's very little emphasis on productivity, on could better techniques have been adopted. Also, socioeconomic and environmental concerns are frequently referred to. The plans refer to rural development, but there's actually nothing in here that's actually about rural development other than saying we'll increase output and that should help rural development. There is concern, and generally in Kazakhstan there's a high awareness of environmental concerns because of the nuclear testing and other things in the Soviet period. But again, in this agriculture policies, although environmental concerns are voiced, there's not much priority given to them. And if we think about what kind of policy is being introduced, it's overwhelmingly a supply-side policy. It's a policy about increasing output. So we have part of Casagro, it's called Casagro Marketing. And what do? They monitor prices. They say, okay, the price in this region of this product is so much, in this region of this product, which actually duplicates what the state statistical agency does. And they provide consulting services, which according to farmers are overwhelmingly about how to get state support for your output. So then not really involved in trying to improve the marketing. And the same thing with the FCC, the grain purchaser. It does little to help farmers to increase unit value. I mean, we see constantly reference to the high quality of Kazakh wheat in domestic documents, but there's not very much attempt to say in the main markets, in the Middle East, in Central Asia, why Kazakh wheat should be at a premium. or to ensure that quality is maintained by improving supply chains. You know, one of the problems is you get your wheat to the Black Sea ports, and it often will get mixed in with lower quality Russian or wheat, which makes it less less easy to get a premium price for it. So, you know, there's not much emphasis on the quality. It's all about quantity. And we see this also, you know, the most recent important trade policy innovation for Kazakhstan is the customs union with Russia and Belarus that came into effect in 2011. That although to some extent that has been liberalizing trade and that Russian tariffs have come down as Russia joined WTO as well, the customs union agreement has many quantitative terms in it. It's often in the form of tariff quotas, saying kind of duty-free up to a certain limit. So there's quantitative targets for the supply of beef from Kazakhstan to Russia, 80 tons a year, which again mean that policy is focused on how to meet this quantity target rather than how to efficiently produce the beef or on the extent to which you should be producing beef or you should be doing something else. And feature of the policy is that, yes, some of the goals are poorly articulated or they're inconsistent. So that, you know, although reference is made to public good provision when I had that list of goals, you know, the share of funds devoted to infrastructure has fallen. And, you know, some of these are difficult questions. You know, when you have a bumper harvest, like in 2011, you know, there's going to be a shortage of rail boxcars and of elevators, and farmers will complain that some people get access, some don't. Then in the last harvest is much lower. That's not a problem. Now, it's not obvious that the government should be providing facilities for the bumper harvest. You know, but, so it's a difficult question, but it seems that there has been less priority on infrastructure. Food security is important. There was this spike in food prices in 2007-2008, after which food security became important for all countries. In Kazakhstan, the government defined this as producing domestically 80% of each food product. Well, you know, this doesn't make a lot of sense in terms of thinking of food security for your poorer households. You know, what we should be worrying about is rural development, a household's ability to obtain food, right, and allow for some substitution between products. So, you know, it's your household incomes are important, I think, if we're worried about food security. And rather than thinking of producing a fixed percentage of each product, some of which, you know, may be better imported than produced domestically. An inconsistency is that since 1996, Kazakhstan has been negotiating WTO accession. It's been through various cycles of appearing closer and then further away. Presumably, it should be very close. You know, Russia is now in the WTO. Tajikistan joined the WTO a few weeks ago. This is clearly the wave. Kazakhstan's in a customs union with Russia. But many of these agricultural subsidies are now obstacles to accession in the way they wouldn't have. They didn't exist 10 years ago. You know, WTO members are committed to having agricultural subsidies being less than 5% of the value of output. There's a lot more than that in Kazakhstan now. So Kazakhstan is busy trying to negotiate exceptions to that. Another inconsistency is in providing subsidized credit. You know, a big part of the actual spending. You know, the Kazagro says it's cooperating with the commercial banks, but by making loans to specific producers, you know, it's crowding out, you know, independent commercial loans, which is what we would think might be, and that's a system that's consistent with a market economy. You have loan officers in banks who decide, you know, which of the loans going to better projects or worse projects. So that's being replaced by decisions being made, you know, by the public servants. You know, so there are these trade-offs going in. And also, you know, which is, you know, fairly obvious when you've got a large program introduced fairly quickly, you know, farmers complain of difficulty in knowing, you know, what's available, where they can obtain it, you know, whether it's the subsidies are arriving when they want, and so on, and inevitably complaints about local officials' performance. Some very specific inconsistencies is that many of the outside studies have recommended increasing production of vegetables like tomatoes, cucumbers, and so on, which could be efficient in semi-arid regions. For that you need drip irrigation, for that you need high quality fertilizers, but the incentives are to use domestic fertilizers, which are not good enough for that. Finally, I think in this kind of list of problems, which it's about agriculture, but it's about what happens when you start to have more interventionist policies. That's the thing. Yeah, we have problems that the division of responsibilities is, you need to have some division of responsibilities. It's not always accompanied by interagency meetings, as it would be in sort of a longer developed system of support for agriculture like you have in the United States, for example, or Canada. So the Ministry of Education finances fundamental research, but the Ministry of Agriculture funds applied research. So that's a pretty arbitrary division sometimes, what's fundamental and what's applied. The implementation is by regional administrations. Some regions are wealthier than others, so there's an inconsistency in the regional inequities, and it may not be the regions with the best prospects for agriculture that have got the most funds. The Ministry of Employment is supposed to provide alternative jobs for self-employed farmers, or by providing microcredit or relocating people from the regions, but that's not a top priority for that ministry. And also there's a gap in terms of the land improvement and the environmental issues. So, if I can summarise what I'm saying about this. Very clearly, Kazakhstan's economic history divides as this divide. The 1990s were a very harsh period, a grim period, and it turns around in 1999, and there's been a boom period since then. And agriculture follows that pattern. And one of the things that's interesting about the boom period is that I think the government has sought, in an admirable way, to use the revenues from the oil boom for future security and for investment in human capital and for improved infrastructure and economic diversification. And what I'm focusing on is the last of those, because when you see almost any country that has one of these resource booms, they get concerned about being too dependent on the natural resource. And an important role in diversification in Kazakhstan, certainly in terms of where the money's being spent, has been agriculture. And the paper here illustrates the steps taken to improve Kazakhstan's position as a major agricultural producer, but also highlights the shortcomings of current policies. And we can look at that by contrasting the goals on the left from the first slide I had about agriculture. What was the 2002 decision to support agriculture? These were the stated goals: ensuring food security, establishing an efficient system, increasing sales, optimizing state support. And if we look at the current policy, really it's almost completely on the third one of these, because it's focusing on output and it's focusing on supply. It's not increasing the value of sales, we're just increasing the quantity of sales. There's very little attention to rural development or rural income support. There's very little attention paid to improving efficiency. It's about encouraging more output. Little attention paid to finding your niches or how you could improve value added by finding better quality. Very little attention also on the trade costs. You're lowering the cost of getting. Kazakhstan's a landlocked country, lowering the cost of getting the grain to the markets. I mean, there are booming markets in the Middle East, in other parts of Central Asia, in Iran, but the transport and transactions costs are quite high. And I said before, I'm not sure what optimising state support means, but there's clearly a lot of inefficiency in the design and implementation. Some of that is inevitable, but some of it follows from having a fairly, a very interventionist policy, a very hands-on policy. So So we think of, you know, the broader relevance of this. You know, Kazakhstan is a resource-rich country, trying to avoid a resource curse outcome. I think makes it an interesting case beyond the individual country. But when we look at what's happening, I think there's this tendency, which may be psychologically fairly pressing, there's been this tendency to become increasingly centralized and interventionist. And I think that's the dilemma that Kazakhstan features in 2013, a feature of the policy making in the country has, I think, been the government's flexibility in adapting policy, but it's going to be tested whether they can adapt the policies in a good way. So I mentioned earlier there's this 2030 strategy. Now the president is now announcing a 2050 strategy, and I think the interesting question will be is whether to what extent he's emphasising the role of the state as in a fairly interventionist way, or whether the state is there to provide framework within which activity will continue. So I think that's all I've got to say. Hopefully move on to any questions.
Yeah, thank you very much. That was an excellent presentation. Unfortunately, around here, even though this is the institute where Jim Millar was once the director and very well-known expert on Soviet economy and agriculture
especially,
we don't have a lot of economic presentations anymore, or a lot of economists involved in our discussion. So let me now throw the floor open to questions. We have as much time as people want. So please just raise your hand and I'll call in. Yes, we'll just go down the list. Go ahead first.
Because I'm an environmentalist, and I taught environmental science at Sichuan University in Western China, not far from Kazakhstan there. And because I worked in Uzbekistan and I'm so conscious of the drying up of the Aral Sea, it looks a little big here for me. I think a later map might show me.
Well, yeah, it's already in two parts, though.
Yeah,
it's an open thing there.
The waters flow from Kazakhstan. And all across northern China, the Gobi Desert is spreading rapidly, and the aquifers are being depleted. I'm amazed and alarmed that so little was said here about the future water supply, the near future water supply. How can agriculture, you said a little bit of one mention of drip agriculture, but also development of virgin lands, which means chopping down the forest, whereas China's madly building up forestry in the Northwest. It sounds like a disaster scenario for lack of water.
Yeah. I mean, I guess some of the things I said were sort of shorthand. I mean, not paying any attention to efficiency is part of that, because
efficiency
to me means
water to drink.
Efficiency means using this using your how your use of resources reflects a relative scarcity, and that's not part of the story.
Right.
And I think there was a slide that said about emphasizing the environment, and that's not been part of the story. So I agree with you. Yeah. I mean, essentially, I think the Kazakhs have given up on the Aral Sea. This would be better if it showed the river going through here. They built just a big dam across there to try to keep their northern bit there. And they've given up on the Uzbeks, basically.
But the Gobi Desert must be spreading all across, not only across China, but across Kazakhstan.
Yeah, but I mean, this area is still not too bad, because you've got all the high mountains and you get the runoff from
that. Well, that's right. Sichuan is okay.
Yeah, this part is desert. I mean, I've driven here, it's just a total barren, yeah.
In fact, my students applauded when we heard that Beijing was worried about desertification in the north. They said, oh, good, the capital will move to Chengdu.
No, I mean, I totally agree with you. Maybe I skated over it too much, but I think...
I think the government.
Yeah, no, that's why I skated over it. I said there's environmental concerns are listed, but they're not really paid a lot of attention to. And then the inconsistency. I mean, there is this sort of drip agriculture, is a no-till agriculture that's supposed to economise on the water, but the complementary inputs, meaning high-quality fertilisers, are being discriminated against by the policy of saying we'll give you an 80% subsidy if you use Kazakh fertilisers. That's a pretty big incentive to use the Kazakh ones, but they're not as good quality.
Okay, we had another question here. Please identify yourself.
Slomi Harak, School of Advanced and International Studies, Johns Hopkins University, Visiting Scholar. I had similar questions on water resources, actually, and on the efficiency and waste of water. Well, we know that Uzbekistan, for instance, they have a lot of problems with waste of water due to maintenance or, but to say, non-maintenance of channels and so on. So maybe you can even more develop this issue. And second question of mine is on the geography of Kazakh export. What are the changes and what's the share of, for instance, Central Asian countries in Kazakh export, Kazakh agriculture export? Because I'm asking because, for instance, for Tajikistan or some part of Kyrgyzstan or Turkmenistan, the import of Kazakh grain is one of the tools of surviving.
Yeah. What was the first part? I think the irrigation issue is nowhere near as bad as Uzbekistan, because most of Uzbekistan's agriculture is irrigated.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a fairly small proportion in Kazakhstan.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just this area of slaughter. This is rain fed. Yeah, this is not so much irrigation in the north, but the problem is that the rainfall is very erratic. You know, so there is an issue, and there's another issue of soil erosion, which is also important. The water issue, I agree with you, it's important, but it's not as critical as Uzbekistan, which is almost going to war with Tajikistan over water. That's for sure. Now, what's striking about when you look at the wheat export, is it do change a lot from year to year. And so it depends a lot on the Kazakh harvest, it depends on harvest in other countries. But the main shift, and it's sometimes hard to tell if it's a shift or whether it's something that's gone up in the last couple of years but will go down again. The main shift has been increasing supplies to Iran, Azerbaijan, and North Africa. You know, so there's a lot more going out across the Caspian or through the Caspian, whereas historically, it was supposed to go to Central Asia, and both Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan have tried to have become more self-sufficient in wheat, which some years they are, some years they aren't. Historically, the rail lines used to always go up through Russia. So if it didn't go to Central Asia, they went to Russia and it wasn't clear where it was ending up. So moving this way is a big change.
Yes, please.
Which should be a positive change for Kazakhstan, in that these are booming markets, of fast-growing populations.
Yeah. Hi, Nate Shankin from Freedom House. That chart you showed showing the difference between agriculture share of GDP and that decreasing, but then the increase in agricultural employment.
Oh yeah.
I think just extraordinary. And I wondered if you could speak a little bit more about it in terms of some other things.
This one?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
That people talk about in Kazakhstan a lot. I mean, we talk a lot about urbanization, people moving into the cities, but then we have an increase in the agricultural employment.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, how does that square? And does this also have implications for the inequality across society as a whole? I mean, does it really mean that the oil boom is, you know, a very select number of relatively high-paying jobs that it's producing, and maybe service industries associated with that? And then there's a bigger group of people who are moving into agriculture. How does this reflect on the larger employment?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very hard to talk about rural-urban migration in Kazakhstan, because...
Yeah.
Yeah, Astana's gone from, 100,000 to 850,000 people have come from somewhere.
Right.
Almaty's increased a little bit. You know, the big oil cities on the Caspian, Akhtar and Atyrau, have increased in size. Shymkent, for some reason, has grown very rapidly, largely from immigrants from outside of Kazakhstan, returning Kazakhs, as they call them. But you've got a load of those mid-sized cities, you know, I mean, particularly these company towns in mining or the ones in the northeast that have actually shrunk in transition. So there has been sort of urban-rural migration there.
So you think this is happening in the north and in the central kind of mining towns?
Well, people are moving, but didn't move. I think the northeast and the east is where this is primarily happening.
Okay.
I mean, the people who move from the towns that declined in the center move to Astana for sure, but maybe some are also moving into agriculture. But I mean, to be frank, I don't know the details.
Well, it's interesting to know, just because I've been in Akhtal, I've been in Atyrau.
They're booming.
I met the guys who've come from Shymkent or have come from rural areas in the south. And so it's interesting to think about people moving into the country. I haven't met them.
Into the villages, you mean?
Yeah, into the villages,
yeah.
Or into the farms, you know. But maybe they're in another part of the country.
Yeah. And Shymkent's amazing because it's become the real center for immigrants.
Yeah.
Which
yeah.
used to be sort of these Kazakhs who were in Mongolia, and places.
Right.
Now it's huge number of people. We're not sure if they're Uzbeks or Kazakhs, but they say the Kazakhs because
there's a lot
better living
standard. Or they could until last year.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, I'm not exactly sure of the geography. I'd also put a little grain of salt on employment data.
Right.
The numbers are so big that it seems it's like it's got to be credible.
It's got to be something like that.
I think it is fairly interesting. And it also does reflect that the other, whatever it is, 95% of GDP, you know, what's been gone up
right.
is obviously energy, and that doesn't employ many people.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
It's some ways an adding up thing, too.
Yeah.
Were there other questions?
I have a quick question. Yes. Since you're Australian, right?
Yeah.
Australia. What made you interested in Kazakhstan? Is there a similarity in parts of Australia to what's happening in Kazakhstan?
Well, Kazakhstan is really similar to Australia. And the only difference being that it's not an island, but it's a big area with most of the people live scattered around the edges,
desert,
and there are more sheep than people. And some imperial power used it to sort of test the nuclear weapons there. But no, it's actually the interesting thing had nothing to do with being Australian. Actually, I started working on Kazakhstan before I moved to Australia. the short history of that is that when the Soviet Union dissolved, the Asian republics became part of the United Nations in the middle of 1992. If you join the United Nations, you're in one of the regional commissions, so they were in the Asia Pacific region. The people in Bangkok at the Asia Pacific Commission for Asia and the Pacific had no idea what to do with Central Asia. They worked on India, they worked on Fiji, they worked on Korea, it was nothing like that. And so they looked for somebody who would go there for a year to advise the governments. And I'd worked on China and I'd worked on Eastern Europe, and I think they thought this was halfway in between. So somehow they got my name and said, will you come and work there? Which was a fascinating thing to do.
I have a small comment on the questions that was asked before about why the share of migration to villages were increased. Because of the crisis, all these people that were involved in this construction industry, they were unemployed.
Yeah.
That's why they had to come back to villages.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think, I mean, I think agriculture plays a really important role as a coping mechanism. It did it in the 1990s, and again in 2008.
They used to be in this agriculture, then they moved to cities because construction boom, like really boom. And then when this whole construction industry was closed, they had to come back.
So you're saying there would be a different story on that diagram if we took 2007 as the final year?
Yeah, sure, it would be like vice versa.
Yeah, that might be true. I mean, that.
Thank you for your interest in Kazakhstan. My name is Nadia Islamova. I'm a Fulbright scholar from Kazakhstan, and my focus of my research is gender economics. My question is, you know that Kazakhstan is 14th country, and
Please speak up a bit.
Kazakhstan is food insecure country. We import more than 60% of food product, according to official data, and according to unofficial data, we import more than 80% of food product. And maybe you know that according to unofficial data, more than 80% of our cattle are affected by brucellosis, and et cetera, et cetera. You know the situation in our agriculture. And your research on our country, what kind of recommendations do you have in order to improve the situation?
Okay.
Feedback for your research.
I think that the issue on food food insecurity. Yeah, to me, this is a matter of people's incomes, really. It shouldn't be just be measured by percentage of imports, right? So we think of many countries that have very high percentage of imports, but you don't think of having food insecurity, Switzerland or something like that. I think related to that size of imports has been the design of the policies. I mean, that Kazakhstan exports raw materials, essentially. It's the grain. There's been a very poor record of developing the even fairly basic processing industries. So a lot of dairy products, for example, come in from Russia because they've been processed, and that's what the supermarkets and other supply chains really want. So I think that one of the ways in which, and this is a big part of the OECD report, is that one of the things that the policy could be improved would be looking at value chains and looking at the issue of not just thinking we need to increase milk output, but what we need to do is to have some way of ensuring there's a cold chain from the milk farmers to the dairies, and that's then related to the retailing. And that, as a recommendation, is important because it would increase farmers' incomes, it would increase the availability of domestic food. But to me, the more important part of that is increasing the farmers' income so they can do the buying. But it would also reduce what you're seeing as a problem, and the government sees as a problem, the higher level of imports. And I think that's the policy is too focused simply on quantities. In terms of animal health, it seems an important way to deal with that is to improve spending on research, on vets, on that kind of infrastructure, rather than just giving incentives to produce more. And that was a stated aim of the policy. When you look at how much spending that goes on vet services and vet training, it's not very much. So, I think there should be less concern of saying, we'll reward you for producing more, we'll give you subsidies, for buying things, for investing. I don't think that's what the real shortage isn't the amount of capital that you have. And so you go to some model dairy farms in Kazakhstan, they've got beautiful imported equipment from Germany, it looks spick and span, but it'd be much more effective if they took over some of the lessons from, say, Poland, where they've used a lot of small dairy farmers, but develop ways in which they can get their milk into the dairy system and actually have it processed. And the supermarkets that are developing in Astana, they want that. They want local suppliers who will be well organized. It just needs some support for the infrastructure. Things like better rural roads would make a difference. It's no point saying you can get fresh milk to a dairy if the truck gets bogged down in the road. So I think worrying about infrastructure, worrying about supply chains, worrying about things like vet services, I think those should be brought into agricultural policy rather than just saying we'll throw money as subsidies to farmers. But that's been my recommendation anyway. Whether the government will listen, I don't know.
I just had a follow-up question because I think you hinted at a little bit that there was an ideological suspicion of market mechanisms or of a market approach to these kinds of things. Do you think that's the whole story? Do you think it's an ideological suspicion? Do you think it's maybe lack of conceptual understanding, perhaps, of some of the ways that a more market oriented system would work? Or do you think there's also some strong motivations on the part of people in government and people who benefit from a system in which you can wash profits or wash research, move monies around and hide them in various accounts and do all the things that are done in other parts of the Kazakh economy, as we know pretty well?
Yeah, I mean, certainly there are interest groups. I'm not sure when we talk about attitudes, because my impression, some of the people here maybe could answer this better than me, but my impression in the administration is that there are big differences between age cohorts. Mm-hmm. That the older policymakers in the 60s are much more, still have very strong ideas from the pre-independence time that size is important, and very sometimes you meet deputy ministers who are very convinced that that scale economies are just tremendous. That's about all that really matters. Mechanization is important. A mechanized farm must be better. On the other hand, and I think the investment in education has played a great role in that. I mean, there are now a cohort of administrators in the 40s who've had, you know, education that included maybe a year or two in North America or Europe or Australia, and they're much more open about these things. So I hesitate to generalize, is what I'm saying. But I mean, I think the financial crisis did play a role in this, though. I mean, a little bit we saw in the West as well. The market doesn't work, is it? Even though, it's not had, it was obviously a shock, but the Kazakh economy has recovered pretty well.
Actually, I'll get to you in a second. I wanted to ask one question myself, which was I wanted to kind of push you on the title of your talk. I didn't really get a clear answer. Is the Kazakh economy more diversified now than it was? I mean, has Kazakhstan overcome the oil, the resource curse? I mean, you sort of point to a lot of problems in the administration of state intervention in the agriculture, a lot of mistakes in agriculture policy, etc. But overall, is the economy more diversified? Could this be a success story, or is it sort of another example of a resource curse?
I don't think it's a resource curse. I really don't. Certainly not so far. It's not. The economy is not more diversified. It's clearly less diversified than it was 15 years ago because of the oil boom.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not in itself a bad thing. You know, it's better to have oil when the price goes up than not to have it. You know, it's how you use it.
Right.
And my valuation is, it's a bit, it's about two-handed economists on the one hand, on the other hand, right? I think the focus that I mentioned on putting it into a fund for future generations, spending a lot on education, spending on infrastructure, spending on diversification, those are really good general pictures. Yeah. When you get to the details of how the diversification has been pushed, I am concerned that it is leading to a more interventionist view of how government should deal with the economy, which is in the longer term might stifle the growth of the non-oil sector.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the downside. And I think we see that agriculture really exemplifies that. We would see it in other parts of the economy with the huge increase in the role of state enterprises.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we're at a bit of a turning point in a sense, and because as I said in my last slide, I think Kazakhstan's policymakers have shown themselves to be quite flexible in terms of changing policies, but the flexibility comes at very high levels. I think it depends a lot on the signals coming from the president.
Please,
I don't know whether you share this. And one thing that strikes me when you go into a ministry is when the president gives his annual speech, if it's a sentence on one particular policy, that policy changes pretty quickly.
I see three more hands. So let's have some new voices.
Please
identify yourself.
Yeah, Natalia Vogst. I coordinate our energy economic summit at the Atlantic Council, which is in Istanbul. So it connects all these regions. I was just curious to whom you think the president of Kazakhstan would listen in this case, and maybe then actually, change policy if it needs to come at such a high level for a decision.
I don't know the answer to that.
I think he
listens to quite a lot
here.
Of people. And I think that's a positive thing. Among leaders who are fairly autocratic. I mean, I think he does listen to a lot of people. Who he takes notice of is, I think, what you're really asking.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure I know the answer to that.
It's because it's so hopeful in a way, and you think, these things could so well apply to countries around Kazakhstan that have similar resource issues where all the money in the economy is coming from one source. And just to talk about diversification and their agriculture, which they also have as something there that from which they could gain.
I mean, it's definitely positive. I mean, it's positive compared to Azerbaijan and just, you know, streets away from Turkmenistan, which is the other energy one. And the other thing that you're not allowed to talk about is that the president is well into is into his 70s. Yeah, so.
Really, I think there was a question here.
My question, Saulia Sataeva, Fulbright Scholar at the American University. I'm a historian and I study the nomad in the past of our people of Kazakhstan. And I would like to ask you that, do you know that in the area of Seven Rivers, which I live in, Almaty, it's a very ancient agricultural area, about 50 rivers, they start in China. And since year by year, the China increase taking water from this river. And this is very ugly effect to increasing our agriculture, our farming. And so also, as a citizen of this area, we also very suffer from a lot of not high quality products of, from China. And they use genetically changed ways to increase the crops, and we are always looking for the products, our local, not Chinese.
No.
And my question is, the second question is that our land is a predisposed to desertification, and in 1950s we had this program to develop virgin lands, and your country also had the same program in 1930s, and it's known as the plug that broke the plain. And my question actually also to ecologists, that how do you solve this problem, because it's about 48 million hectares of our land is destroyed by this desertification, and it's very difficult to fix this problem. And how is how you solve in your country this problem, because you still have this problem, and I think it's in the west and in the center of US.
Yeah, this dust bowl phenomenon. Now, I mean, in that, when the virgin lands came down here, I mentioned this World Bank estimate that about 30% it comes down here. As you get further south, there tend to be the more marginal lands. And the World Bank estimate was that 30% of these lands should not have been brought into production, given on average what the rainfall would be. And because the soils are delicate, that's a major problem. So, in some ways, when we look at the fall of grain output, some of it was taking some of this land out of production. It was, in some ways, not a bad reallocation. But it depends what the long term is. These border water disputes are just really difficult, aren't they? There's got to be some resolution.
Political questions. Political issue.
Yeah. We've talked already about the Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, which to me is the most likely cause for interstate war in the region. It also applies here. I think less urgent in that your region it's not on such a balance, but it is a problem. I'm not trying to minimise these things. They definitely are there. We talked about the environmental issues. One of the problems with this program of increasing beef output to meet the 80 ton target in the customs union is how do you feed the beef? You've got to grow something that they're going to be fed. Where are you going to grow it? It's putting more pressure on the land. And I don't know what the answer is to that. My response as an economist is that the best answer would be to try to get prices that reflect true scarcities, and let farmers decide what they do. I think with the state deciding we need such a herd of cattle and we're going to import all these thousands of purebreds from North Dakota and elsewhere, not necessarily the right way to go. It seems quite likely the wrong way to go. But it's not a good. I know it's not a good answer to your question. Yeah. But so, you know, the ultimate problem in Central Asia is this resistance to pricing water. You know, water's scarce; it should be priced. But everywhere there's a reluctance to doing that because that's really you want farmers to know this is something that's scarce. And if they can introduce techniques that save water, that's a good thing. But currently, there's not really much incentive to reduce your water use for the individual farmer as long as the water is free, and then you complain when it stops flowing.
Well, it's 5:30, so I'm afraid we'd run out of time. But if you, I'd like to invite you before you leave, if you'd like to have some cookies or take some coffee with you, we still have lots of extras here. But please join me in thanking Richard for an excellent presentation.
Thanks. And if anybody has any comments, I mean, I don't think my email address is on here, but it's really easy. It's just richard.pomfret. And if you do any search on Google, there are no other Richard Pomfret in the world.
You're the only one?
I'm the only one that comes up.
I'm the only Robert Horton.
Yes,
yeah.
Give any of a copy.
That's the last one, I think.
We met about 5-6 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.